Kentucky Psychologist, a podcast brought to you by the Kentucky Psychological Association. The Kentucky Psychologist will get into the minds of top psychologists from Kentucky and occasionally friends from across the country. We'll talk about what leading mental health experts are interested in and excited about. Hear about all the ways psychologists in clinical practice, research, leadership, and applied settings are doing to improve and save lives. Dr. Courtney Keim is an associate professor of psychology at Bellarmine University and an industrial and organizational psychologist with over 10 years of teaching and consulting experience. Her research focuses on organizational wellness and psychologically healthy workplace practices, personality, and pedagogical best practices. She has given numerous talks to national and local government agencies, businesses, and professional associations on best practices in workplace wellness. Dr. Keim has consulted with organizations including departments within Louisville Metro Government, Norton Behavioral Health Medicine, Maryhurst, and Lantech Corporation. Dr. Keim also teaches a variety of psychology courses, supervises psychology internships, and advises and mentors students. She is also a Scientific Affairs Committee member for the Society of Occupational Health Psychology.
Joining us today, Dr. Keim, how are you?
Yeah, Sam, thank you. I'm great, and I'm really happy to be here. Thanks for asking me.
Yeah, so go ahead and just tell us a quick bio opposed that about what you do with KPF. So KPF is our nonprofit sister of KPA. So it's the Kentucky Psychological Foundation. And then also what you do at Bellarmine.
Yeah, so at Bellarmine, I'm an associate professor of psychology. My background is in industrial organizational psychology. So as an IO psychologist, I tend to supervise and teach classes in our HR concentration in the psychology department. So I do that. And then I also, as you mentioned, a KPF. So I'm the current president of the Kentucky Psychological Foundation and lead the board in all of the initiatives that KPF is working on.
That's so awesome. We're excited to have you. And we're so happy you've been on our KPF board for quite some time and really growing that nonprofit side of KPF to be more public facing.
Yes. And we might get into it a little bit in this conversation, but it was a little bit of serendipity that got me involved in KPF, but I'm so happy that I was asked to join the board and that I've been able to serve in that role for so long. It's been a really fulfilling experience for me.
Yeah. So we'll actually jump right into that. So first we'll start with, how did you get involved with KPA?
Well, I think you would probably hear the same story from other people who've gotten involved in KPA. I was approached by our executive director at the time, Lisa Wilner, who was an adjunct professor at Bellarmine. And she knew that I was an IO psychologist and that I had passion about reducing stress in the workplace. And when I was talking to her about the courses that I was teaching and the research that I was doing, she said, you know, you might be really good for this committee that we have. And at the time, there was a Psychology in the Workplace Network, which was a committee that fell under the umbrella of the American Psychological Association. And she asked me to just join the committee. Just join the committee. You'd be great on this committee. So I joined that committee. And then shortly thereafter, became the chair of that committee. And as the chair of that committee, I became a KPF board member. And then I became a KPF board member and then eventually was, you know, fell into that role of KPF president. So it really started with this small ask. And really, the reason why I kept sticking around is because I found the work to be so compelling and important and the people to be so wonderful to work with, to be around. It was this group of Kentucky psychologists that were passionate about the science of psychology, passionate about educating the public. Those were things that I was also passionate about. And so when they kept asking me to do a little more and a little more, these were things that I wanted to say yes to. And these are people who I wanted to continue to work with. So it was an easy decision for me to keep saying yes.
We are very happy that you have stayed around and we're glad that Lisa gave that small plug to you and that look where you have gone and look how much growth you've brought to this organization on both sides.
Yeah. Thank you, Sam.
So quickly just tell us, like, what brought you to psychology? Like, what made you decide I want to go into psychology and then specifically into the IO field?
Oh, goodness. Well, we could probably do a whole podcast just about that, about my journey in my career of psychology. The short version is that for the longest time, I really just had no idea what I wanted to do. And I really like to tell that story because I think that sometimes our students come to us with this expectation that they should have a passion and that they should, that passion should be driving their career choices and that they should be certain about their career path when they're 17, 18 years old, declaring a major in college. And that was not the case for me. I was a pre-med major. I failed many of those pre-med classes in college. I was very lost about what to do. And one of my friends in college said, you know, you keep taking all of these psychology classes and you also really love kids. Perhaps child psychology might be the path for you. And I thought that that would be a good path for me. And after I got my undergrad in psychology, I went in and got some experiences working with young kids in a residential treatment facility, being more in that therapeutic role. And I absolutely hated it. It was awful. It was so stressful. It was hard for me to realize that that was not a good fit for me. So I was lost for a very long time. And even when I decided after taking some years off that I might want to go back and get a graduate degree, I still didn't know what area of psychology that I wanted to go into. And I thought maybe a master's in psychology program would help me have a little bit of time to explore and get into grad school and further my career without having to choose. But I didn't get into that program the year that I applied. So I had to wait a whole nother year. And it really was a process of elimination. I realized that clinical psychology was not for me and my skill set. I was not interested in neuropsychology. I had an opportunity as an undergrad to do an internship with a neuropsychologist, and I just didn't really like that kind of hospital setting. I eliminated, I eliminated neuroclinical social. So what's left? Like, by the time you eliminate all of these areas, I kept coming back to the IO field, and I've worked since I was 16 years old. I've had jobs. I had lots of practical, real-world work experience that I could immediately apply that IO concept to. And even still, I was not sure that IO was for me. When I read the descriptions of it, I was like, I don't know. This like selection and recruitment and IO psychologists might be called to testify in lawsuit. I was like, oh, this all sounds terrible. That's not really what I want to do, but there's no other options left. It wasn't until I was actually in an IO grad program and had the opportunity to do two things. Number one, to teach, and number two, to get involved in the occupational health psychology field, that I finally found the thing that I was passionate about. Having the opportunity to be a TA and to teach courses gave me this experience that said, wow, maybe teaching is the thing that is really exciting me, that's building this passion in me that I didn't know that I had. And then finding out that there was a whole area of IO psychology that was all about health and wellness and workplaces and reducing stress and crafting workplaces so that people could be psychologically healthy. That was when I finally said, okay, if that's what part of IO is, then IO is for me. So it took many, many years and many experiences for me to realize, to have those kind of aha moments, to realize that like psychology is for me and that IO is for me and teaching is for me.
That's such a unique journey that you went through to find out like what you're like, where you're at now. And wow, like all the trials you went through and just trying to navigate that and that you stuck with it. And that's really impressive. And I'm so happy that you've, you know, where you're at today, like that's amazing. And most people don't hear those journeys. They always hear, oh, I immediately knew what I wanted to do. I went to it and then I found it. And it's so interesting to hear someone of your caliber that like, it took me a long time to figure out where I was going to go. So I think that's really humbling. And like, it shows like, if you're going into psychology, like don't give up, you might find like a couple other routes that will help you navigate to where you want to be.
Yes. And I agree, Sam. Like, I think that a lot of times there is this expectation of a very clear path in your career. And a lot of the people that I talk to, that path is not linear. It is not straight. There's a lot of forks in the road. There's deviations, there's uncertainty. And that's life, right? Like that. And I think that the background in psychology that I have allowed me that kind of flexibility and adaptability for when those challenges came and when new paths arose, that I had the confidence to take them and see where this leads me. But also knowing that I had this great foundation that in psychology that was going to help me be successful no matter where that final path ended up.
That's so awesome. Yeah, I love hearing that, and that everyone's journey is so unique. So you touched base a little bit on your teaching. What do you love most, or what brings you the most joy in your current work situation where you are a professor and you're also a president and you're also just involved in so many different avenues? So which, can you touch basically or briefly just on like a couple great things that you're experiencing and doing that bring you joy within each of those areas?
Yeah, I know it's going to sound a little silly, but I honestly get really excited knowing what topic I'm about to go and teach the students next. So when I look at, I teach a lot of intro to psychology to a lot of non-psychology majors, and I get excited about the fact that, oh, I get to teach them about reliability and validity today, or I get to teach them about personality assessment. I get to teach them about psychological disorders. I get to explain to them about, I mean, I know it's going to sound really silly, but like, oh, we get to do the cognitive dissonance activity today. I really find passion in teaching new people, new students, how the science of psychology can actually impact them and their lives, no matter what their career is. They're not all going to be psych majors. They're going to go into a variety of careers. They're going to have a variety of experiences as a person, as a parent, as a family member, as a community member. And so I really get excited about thinking about all of these things that we know from the science of psychology that I can teach these people that may actually help them like lead better lives. It sounds a little Pollyanna. And if you don't know what that reference means, you'll have to Google it because that's a very old movie. But it really is true. Like I really enjoy that. And I also really enjoy mentoring the students and watching them grow over the beginning of their careers over the course of the years, to see them as first year students in my intro to psych class, to graduating seniors, to their first job, to getting into grad school. Being able to see their career trajectories is like so incredibly fulfilling. I have no idea what my part is in that, but just knowing that I had a part in it or a small part in it is very, very fulfilling.
That's so nice to hear. And yeah, I think psychology touches in every work environment, wherever you pursue your career. And I think that's really impactful that you're so passionate about teaching that to these students and letting them see your passion about it. Because I think a lot of people think of like a psych 101 course, oh, it's just basic, you know, we have to have this requirement, but you're making it so, you know, passionate and you have that passion behind it. So I think it just brings more joy to students to be able to see that and showing psychology in a different light. What do you like most about your position with KPF right now as being president?
Well, being president of KPF is, again, amazing because I'm surrounded by this group of Kentucky psychologists who want to give back to their communities, who want to make an impact on the health and well-being of people across Kentucky. I love being able to be a part of that group. One of the best things is that we are a relatively new organization. So KPA has been around for 90 years. KPF has been around for, I guess, about 10 or so years. We really recognized, I think KPA recognized the need for a separate nonprofit 501c3 organization that could focus not on membership, but on educating all Kentuckians. And we had a few initiatives that we inherited, if you will, from the APA structure, but that APA structure no longer exists. So we have, over the past couple of years, we have this opportunity to kind of create whatever we want. And so there have been like new initiatives that have come up that KPF has been able to lead, such as our community mental health fund, our leadership academy, our mentorship program for undergraduate and graduate students. These are all came out of meetings that we had where people just came up with ideas and passionate people grabbed onto those ideas and said, this sounds like something that could really be beneficial. Let's do it. And then we have great support from the staff who are able to help us organize and actually make these ideas like come to fruition and help us find grant money and sources for funding to make these initiatives successful. So yeah, being the leader, if you will, of an organization that's relatively new with new ideas and passionate people, it's kind of like what's not to love about that. That's a really fulfilling role for me to take on.
No, it's super exciting. I've been with KPA for about 6 years, going on 7 years, and seeing the growth in the past few years has been absolutely phenomenal, and seeing all the ideas that you all are coming up with within the board and seeing the growth that they're bringing and whatever is next to come is super exciting for this community. What or who helped shaped you, or were your prime influences in psychology? Like who was the person that was like, you're like, I'm gonna, you know, do this? Who helped you?
Yes. Well, my undergraduate mentor was the person who, after seeing me go through so many setbacks and seeing me be so lost, she was the one who looked at me and said, you need to go to grad school. And before she said those words, I never thought that I was grad school material. I never thought that that was an option for me. I never even considered it. So having her see something in me that said, this is the kind of path that you could take, that changed the way that I thought about myself. It changed the way that I thought about what my potential career paths could be. Dr. Tracy Burke, she was my mentor, and I will forever be grateful to her for, again, having me change the way that I think about myself. And she also continued to be a mentor to me, even after I graduated from college, which is something that I try to do now, like pay that forward. So I want to be able to keep in touch with my students who graduate and continue to be a resource for them, even after their graduation, to continue to be someone that they can come to for letters of recommendation, or someone that they can come to for a reference if they need to, and just to like continue to be their cheerleader. When I was in grad school, I was very fortunate to have a wonderful mentor and major professor, Dr. Ron Landis. And one of the things that Ron did that I also try to implement now, he had a way of making you feel like the work that you were doing was incredibly important. I knew that my master's thesis was not going to cure cancer. That's not what IO psychologists do. And yet when I walked into meetings with him to talk about my thesis topic, he made it seem like what I was doing actually might make a difference in people's lives. You can do this study and find some research finding that can be applied to workplaces that can make a meaningful difference. So just having that connection of this immediate work that I'm doing could be impactful, that was huge. And also something that now I'm trying to do with my students as well, is to have them kind of maybe reframe the work that they're doing, the research that they're doing, the coursework that they're doing, to say, this is not just like checking a box so that you can get a degree, but perhaps this work could actually be impactful and meaningful. So yeah, those two people definitely are people that I reflect on a lot, as now I'm in that role myself as being a mentor, and how could I be an effective mentor to my students?
That's really awesome. I'm glad that you've had those people help, you know, guide you as mentors, and plug our mentorship program maybe. With that, it's like having those people that will support you and always in your corner. I think that's huge for any person in any career.
And just so you know, Tracy Burke, she was very much involved in the honors program at my alma mater at Christian Brothers University. And she would run into the current honors program director at Bellarmine. They would see each other at conferences, and I would get random text messages from her because she had like swiped my colleague's phone and was texting me and saying like, I hear you're doing great things. Like, she still, you know, 20 years later is being that advocate for me and, you know, speaking highly of me when I haven't had her, I haven't been in her classroom in 20 years, and yet she's still doing that. It really makes a huge difference to know that those people like stay in your corner, not just that they were advocating for you and being in your corner at the time, but that they continue that advocacy and support is like, yeah, it makes you feel really special. And like, you know, like, wow, I'm a really special person that she's still doing that. Like it, but it does, it continues to make a difference when your mentors support you years later.
So if anyone listening, your mentors, mentees, reach out, say you're proud of someone. I think that will just make someone's day, and you never know what impact you made in someone's life. So continue to reach out and just share those little things. If it's a quick text or a quick email, I think those, they go much further than you might think. So
there's really nothing awesome better. For you to share. There's nothing better than getting even a very quick email from a student that I taught 10 years ago that just says, hey, I just wanted to let you know, I went to law school and I made partner now. Like, it's not that I necessarily need to have the validation that I did that. It's not me. It's just knowing that that student that I supported at one point, like, continues to be successful. Yeah, that can make a huge difference to people. Don't underestimate those small moments of sharing your successes with the people that helped you get there so that they can celebrate with you, even from afar.
That's so awesome. So we talked a little bit about your past. What are you most excited about for psychology in the future? Is there something upcoming that you're super excited about, you know, in the next 6 months, the next 2 years, the next 5 years, maybe you're working on some research? What's bringing you the most excitement right now?
Yeah, well, a couple of things that I'm super excited about. I did a COVID study on psychologically healthy workplaces and the effect that different practices and policies that organizations were doing. I was looking to see what effect that those had on employees and the organization during the height of COVID. And what I found was that in general, the organizations that had policies that were including employee and voice in decision-making, that were recognizing employees for good work, that were still focusing on growth and development opportunities during the height of COVID, those organizations had better employee outcomes. So there was less stress, more motivation, more job satisfaction, and they had better organizational outcomes. So higher performance and less turnover. So it was really kind of a test, if you will, of like, okay, the science of psychology. Yes, if you do all these psychologically healthy workplace practices, it makes a difference. But like, what if it happens during a global pandemic? Will it still work? Will it still hold true? So the fact that it worked and that it actually worked incredibly well during COVID, I think that really gives some kind of comfort potentially to organizations that whatever the next crisis is, whatever that could be economic downturn, it could be a merger, it could be acquisition, it could be some kind of major change that has to happen, some technology, that even during times of those major crises or major change, organizations can still look to the science of psychology and say, what do we do? Is this still going to be effective if we follow what the research says? So the fact that like the research still held during the height of COVID is, I think that that's a really incredibly important message. And similar to that, there's a group of psychologists that I am affiliated with called the Psychology in the Workplace Collaborative. This is a group of people, we've been working together for over 10 years. We used to be part of a strategic group. What was it called? The Strategic Advisory Panel for the American Psychological Association. We used to be the ones that would evaluate organizations for their psychologically healthy workplace awards, which APA doesn't do anymore. So we have decided to form our own group, and in collaboration with KPF, one of the things that we're really passionate about, again, is like helping to educate actual executives and organizations. What does the science of psychology say that can help you be an effective leader and help your organization be the best that it can be, productive, and while also maintaining the focus on employee health and well-being? So we're going to be doing an event for executives in October, on October the 6th. That's going to be a virtual panel. We've got a great lineup of speakers that are going to come and talk about the science behind organizational trust and leadership and how leaders can do things in organizations to build trust. And we also have panelists who are leaders in their organizations who are going to talk about what have they done well and maybe like not as well, that to build trust and how can they maintain trust, and especially maintaining trust again during uncertain times, during COVID, during organizational change, like can the science of psychology still apply? So that event is going to have networking opportunities for the people who attend the event to be able to get into small groups and talk with each other about what's working well in their companies. And then also the opportunity to continue to communicate post event and have kind of that cohort of people that they can turn to as they work to build trust in their own organization. So if you go to psychologycollaborative.com or if you go to the KPF website, you'll find links to more about that event. But it's just, it's really actually years and years and years of passion that this group of people has, again, about not just having psychologists talk to each other, but having psychologists talk to the business leaders that actually could implement policies and changes that would make a difference in so many people's lives. Like, that's really what this event is about. So I'm super excited to have that happen. Again, that'll be later in October of this year.
Well, that sounds like a really awesome event that you guys are putting on to have all of these leaders come and talk about what's going on. And especially what you brought up, like what didn't work. And I think that's huge and super impactful that people just kind of like, this is what works. This is what works for us. This is what works for us. But like letting people know that like things don't work sometimes and that's okay. And we've navigated it to find something that does work for our organization or our company. So I think that's really huge that they're doing that. You quickly touched on your research with COVID. So one of the questions I'm going to ask is, how has COVID shifted your work? Like, what has made a difference? What works? What doesn't work? Working from home, you're a professor, so you're also teaching remotely. Is it a different environment now that you're back in person? How are things going since where you've kind of moved out of the pandemic?
Yeah, well, I mean, COVID changed everything, right? Like this was an event, a global event that changed the way that almost every single person does their job. Whether you were a frontline worker who was always working in person, that still changed the way that you did your job. The people who stocked the grocery shelves at Kroger, I mean, now, I think because of the pandemic, we saw this incredible increase in like the, you know, that you come pick it up curbside to get your groceries. So now when you go to the grocery store, there's all of these workers who are like wheeling around these little carts, right? Where they're fulfilling all these online orders that are happening. I wish that I had that when I had a 6-month-old that was crying in the backseat of my car instead of having to take that crying 6-month-old baby with me into Target. So I think in some ways it has changed so many people's work for the better, that there are things that we do now that we didn't used to do before. It's not like I am, you know, posting every single lecture video. I'm not turning my classes into a YouTube series, but I recognize now that there is an opportunity for students to be able to engage with course material in a way that's very different. I'm teaching an asynchronous online course right now, but I'm also teaching in-person courses right now. So that having that flexibility for students to be able to engage with the content at the time that they can engage with it in the way that works best for them. I mean, I think that that's going to lead to better learning for the students. The good news is, and I told a lot, I was able to be a guest speaker and invited to do a lot of talks during COVID. And what I kept telling people was the good news is that there's already a couple decades of research in the IO field about virtual work. Like this is something that people have actually been studying for a little bit of time now. We know what makes for effective virtual teams. We know about work-life balance and work-life flexibility and the importance of that. So the research is already there to guide us on best practices for how do you manage people remotely. I see it's very interesting to me that recently there seems to be a big pushback where a lot of companies are saying, no, you got to come back in the office. You got to come back in the office. I think that that's a real missed opportunity that these organizations are having. I think that one of the things that a lot of companies have not done a good job of is teaching supervisors how to supervise remote workers. And in the absence of knowing how to do that, they're just making the workers come back because supervisors only know how to manage people when they can see them. in person. And we know that that kind of policy of everybody has to come back may not be really effective for all kinds of organizations, that people do appreciate the flexibility that comes with being able to work remotely sometimes. The work-family conflict or work-life conflict, it's called different things in different research studies, but that kind of stress that happens when people experience the conflict between the demands of my home life and my work life, that kind of stress is significant. We have lots of studies to show that it's incredibly detrimental to people's health and well-being and their productivity as employees if they're experiencing that significant work-life conflict. One study found that people who were experiencing those work-life conflicts were like 30 times more likely to experience a mental health event or a mental health diagnosis, right? So it really behooves companies to not push all the way back against the work from home flexibility and to think about what are the ways in which I can manage people who work remotely. A lot of it goes into trust. Do I trust that my employees are still going to be doing the work and that they're going to do it effectively if they're working from home? So, you know, that's a bigger issue. Like if you don't trust your employees, that's bigger than like whether or not they're at the desk in the office or if they're at their desk at home. That's getting to more problems related to organizational culture and, you know, how things are done, the programs that are done in an organization, how people are evaluated. So I would say like what COVID did is it kind of pushed a button and shook everything up, and how things are settling down. I think that there's still an opportunity for there to be like more consideration for, it doesn't have to go back exactly the way that it was before. Like we've changed everything so much that things can actually be different in a way that's really beneficial for everybody, not just the people who are working from home, but actually for the companies that are also going to see that increased productivity.
Well, that's so interesting to hear. And like that you, like this research was going back way before COVID. And how do you think your colleagues might describe you? Put you on the spot.
Yeah, I don't know how they would describe me. That's a good question. I would hope that they would say that I am a kind person who is compassionate and nice. I hope that they would describe me as someone who works hard, who has a good work ethic, and you know, someone who's smart and intelligent. That would also be nice since I have a PhD. It'd be nice if those two things actually meshed up. You want your colleagues to say very kind and nice things about you. I would hope that would be the case.
Yeah, I think that's what everyone's end goal is, hoping that not everyone's going to like you, but that the people that you work with very closely are thinking that you're kind and you're passionate and, you know, about your job and things like that. So we briefly talked about your research and things like that. Is there any other research that you're doing right now that's super exciting to you?
Well, that's a good question. I was just on sabbatical last fall, so I was working on a lot of different research projects kind of at the same time. One of the projects that I am looking at is more of like a what to do in the classroom kind of project. So what are some best practices for engaging students in the classroom? I've also been working on a project, and I'm going to be presenting at a conference in 2 weeks on this. So I'll be presenting at SIOP, which is the Society for Industrial Organizational Psychologists, a panel on family leave policies. So I've been doing a little bit of research on family leave policies over the years, and we're going to be talking about effective ways of implementing paid family leave and what organizations should know about the research on paid family leave, why they should do it, how it benefits workers and them. And if they are offering paid family leave, how to effectively communicate that to their employees so that their employees actually feel comfortable taking that paid family leave.
That's really interesting stuff that you're doing, and I'm excited that you're presenting on it at SIOP. That'll be a good platform. So I'm excited to see what you bring back, and maybe we can have you present on something like that in Kentucky soon. So we're almost about to wrap things up here. I hate saying this term, but we're going to circle back to what you said about your unique journey to becoming to where you are now. What advice would you give to anyone, undergraduate, graduate students, someone taking gap years, someone that might be early on or later on in their career? What advice would you give them to keep going forward with their, you know, if they're going to pursue psychology, what would advice would you give them?
My biggest advice is to have people have as many experiences as possible. And what I mean by experiences is that, especially when I'm thinking about like my undergraduate students, there's only so much introspection that you can do. There's only so many like career assessments or personality or interest assessments that you can do before you have to just get out there and try it. So even though it was a terrible experience for me, working in a residential treatment facility was an experience that helped me realize that's something I didn't want to do. Working in a neuropsychology lab on an internship helped me realize that was something that I didn't want to do. And so I really encourage students, especially internships, job shadowing, you know, even just having interviews with people who are in the field. I love to take a field trip. I don't know about you, but I love a field trip. And that's one of the things that you still kind of get to do as an IO psychologist, especially if you're consulting with organizations, is you still get to do field trips because you get to go on site visits. And I think that that's a great opportunity. If you can find someone that you can job shadow for a day, or if you can go to a company and just ask to take a tour, that's an experience that can help you realize, is this something that I might want to do? And then just also to really be reflective of those experiences when you have them. What was it about that experience that was good or bad? Maybe it wasn't really working with the kids that was so bad. Maybe it was the environment in which I was working. It was how I was treated by my colleagues and my coworkers. It was lack of supervision and support from my manager. So that's something too, being introspective and thoughtful about what those experiences brought you and what you learned about yourself, so that that kind of guides the next decision. Okay, now what experience would I like to have? I think it could be small things like serving on a committee can be a great way to see, is this an area that I'm passionate about? Is this something that I might want to do? If you're someone who's more of like in the clinical field, I think having volunteer experiences with different kinds of populations can be good. I don't know if I want to work with kids. I don't know if I want to work with older adults. Okay, well then go volunteer at, nursing home. We don't call them nursing homes anymore. What are they called now?
Retirement places. I don't even know.
Yeah. So you could go and volunteer at a retirement home, or go and volunteer at a preschool. I mean, goodness gracious, like don't our schools and our teachers need as much support as possible? Like maybe you could go to the elementary school down the street from you and just like volunteer to go read a book to a class for a day, give a teacher a break to, you know, that kind of thing. So that's what I mean. Just like as many experiences as you can have, volunteer, job shadow, internship, whether they're formal or informal experiences, you're going to learn something about yourself, and it will help you further yourself down that really windy, crazy path of your career. Even if you're not going in a straight line, you're still moving forward and understanding who you are and what you might want to do.
That's really great advice. Like get out, get connected, shadow people. I think those are just huge things that people just don't think. And like, as you said, stuff isn't linear. It's going to go around, find things that are, you know, you're passionate about and try them out.
there's no harm in trying things out. As we wrap up, I've got one last question for you. We're in all of our podcasts like this. If you were to be approached to do karaoke, what would be your go-to song?
Nothing, because I would, I'm not a karaoke fan. I don't like to sing. I don't sing well. I've never done karaoke in my life, and I don't think I ever will. I'm certainly not missing anything. I've seen enough karaoke to know that that's not for me. So, and it's really interesting too, because I come from a very musical family. My father is a musician. He's in multiple bands. I grew up watching my dad on stage. I can very vividly remember my dad, who one of the bands that he's in is a Pink Floyd cover band. My dad was performing in his band. I was probably like, I'm not kidding you, like 8 or 10 years old, very, very young. And they were performing, they were singing Comfortably Numb. And I was in the audience silently singing every word to the song, not out loud, never in a microphone, never on stage. But I knew every word of that song. So like, you know, I'm happy to be the person who's like, knows words to songs and maybe sings it myself in the car. So maybe a Beatles song or a Pink Floyd song might be one that I would sing by myself to myself. But never, ever, ever, Sam, would you see me on a karaoke stage. I'm a very extroverted person, but I just don't have that gene that other people in my family have. That gene, that gene was not passed down to me. I can't do it.
So you'll catch Courtney and I watching everyone perform, because I also will never be on a karaoke stage. So you guys want to perform karaoke for Courtney and I, go for it. Otherwise we'll just be sitting in the back. That's really funny to hear that you come from such a background, yes, of music, and that you're just like, nope, not for me.
Yeah. It's just not for me. It's just not for me. Nope. No, but yes, Sam and I will be in the back, clapping along and being very happy for you all as you were singing on the stage.
All right. So we're wrapping things up. How can people find you, on LinkedIn, you know, Twitter, where are you at? Where can people find you? We'll include all this in the show notes as well, but you know, where can they find you?
I'm on LinkedIn. I'm not very, active on LinkedIn. I, you know, probably like once a month kind of LinkedIn person, but I'm definitely on there, and we'll connect with folks in that way. I am one of those people that's still holding on to Twitter for better or worse. I've joined a couple of other networks, but I keep hoping that Twitter is going to become a better place. and for me personally, I have made so many connections, professional connections with people on Twitter. I'm very, very heavy with my mute and block. And I use the muted words feature on Twitter aggressively. So I only see the things that I really want to see and only follow the people that I want to follow on there. And I've made some really great connections. So you can definitely find me on Twitter. That's unfortunately, perhaps that's where I'm the most active.
No, that's awesome. Yeah, I'm still holding out for Twitter as well. I think it's a great platform, and it's been utilized super well. And I think, you know, we'll see how it goes. But thank you so much for joining us today on this episode of the Kentucky Psychologist. We're super excited about this psychology collaborative event that you're having in October. We'll share that information in the show notes as well, and link that to Courtney's episode when we push it out. So again, thank you, Courtney, for having us, and I hope you have a wonderful day.
Yeah. Thank you, Sam.